Karl Marx is famous for saying, "Religion is the opiate of the people." His point, if you read the context of that passage written back in 1844, was that religion dulls people and anesthetizes people to the pain of their situation so that they can do nothing about it. People lose the capacity, he said, to face the realities of life and make the changes necessary to pursue real happiness because of the narcotic of religion, according to Karl Marx. Well, I think Karl Marx is right if you add a word to that. False religion is the opiate of the people. False religion is the narcotic that dulls human senses. False religion satisfies people with a false sense then of well-being, provides people with the illusion of security and hope and well-being, happiness. And that's why false religion must ultimately be destroyed in this world. And that is the message in a nutshell of Revelation 17. You may have read the news reports from just this last month, July, about 10-year-old Sajani Shakya, who almost lost her status as a living goddess. In the Kathmandu Valley of Nepal, living goddesses called Kumari are chosen from the same Hindu caste as Buddha, and they are worshipped as deities. And they live well, very luxurious lives from a tender age. But as Sajani learned, with the elevated status comes some elevated expectations. Under no circumstances was she ever to leave the country of Nepal. So Nepalese authorities were outraged when she chose to travel to the United States to participate in a documentary that was being filmed about the Kumari tradition. And upon her return, she received notification of termination from her goddess status by the chief of the government trust that manages the affairs of the living goddesses. However, after some pressure from the public and Sajani's own expressions of remorse, the government has since offered a reprieve to her. Sajani will retain her title if she faithfully goes through an intense cleansing process that washes her sins, or the sins of the countries where she visited in her travels. So essentially, she was fired as a goddess and then rehired as a goddess. Now, it is sad to me that people can actually believe in such a living goddess. And yet, goddess worship is as old as Babylon. What does God have to say about false religion in Revelation chapter 17? Well, first of all, Satan's wine intoxicates the world, verses 1 through 6. And one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I shall show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth committed acts of immorality, and those who dwell on the earth were made drunk with the wine of her immorality. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness. And I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having seven heads and 10 horns. And the woman was clothed in purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality. And upon her forehead a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus." Revelation chapter 17 and 18 are allegories, if you will, about a woman bedecked with jewelry. Essentially, the word is gilded with gold, and covered in scarlet robes, who rides a scarlet beast. You will notice that the woman is called a prostitute, and that she intoxicates the people of this earth with her wine. She, in turn, is intoxicated by the blood of the saints who are witnesses to Jesus Christ. This woman is the opiate of the people in this world, if you will. She makes them forget their problems with the lures of her success. She loves the world, and the world loves her. The only group she hates, there is only one in all of the world, the only group she hates is God's people. And she seeks to consume all of God's people as her enemies. Who is this woman? You will notice that she is described as a prostitute who is sitting on a beast near many waters, holding a golden cup in her hand. The background for that imagery comes from the Old Testament prophet Jeremiah, who wrote an extensive prediction about the city of Babylon back in his day, 500 plus years before Christ walked this earth. In Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 7, Jeremiah wrote, "Babylon has been a golden cup in the hand of the Lord, intoxicating the earth. The nations have drunk of her wine. Therefore the nations are going mad." He continued in verse 13 of Jeremiah 15 with the words, "O you," the woman that he is describing, "O you who dwell by many waters, abundant treasures, your end has come." And then John, of course, describes this woman as having a golden cup in her hand, and upon her forehead is written a name, a mystery: Babylon the Great, the mother of immorality and of the abominations of the earth. Some have thought that her name was Mystery Babylon. But in fact, grammatically, the word mystery is not part of her name. Her name is a mystery. And in the scriptures, a mystery, over and over again, is something that has heretofore been unknown that God now reveals. So Babylon the Great is a mystery that has been unknown and is now being revealed in Revelation chapter 17. Her name is Babylon the Great, mother of immorality and of the abominations of the earth. In other words, she is the source and progenitor of immorality. She gave birth to the intoxicating, seductive forces that addict people in this world. How do we understand the allegory here? Well, it's very important to understand this. The sexual terms that are being used here are not primarily talking about sexual immorality at all. The Old Testament often pictured the idolatry of God's people in sexual terms, calling idolatry adultery and sexual immorality. You see, God often in the Old Testament pictured Israel as his wife. And when Israel went off and worshipped other gods and goddesses in this world, when she succumbed to idolatry, he said that Israel was being a prostitute. She was prostituting herself. So this is not a story here in Revelation about sexual immorality. It is a story about spiritual immorality. Babylon the Great is the mother of spiritual immorality, of those who say they follow God but pursue the gods of this world, pursue idolatry. She is the mother of idolatry then. Babylon the Great is the source of the false religion that anesthetizes mankind by the worship of idols. That's the point of the allegory in Revelation 17. Now in Revelation 18, we continue with the allegory of Babylon. But there, the mother of idolatry becomes the mother of materialism and of luxury and of comfort. So in Revelation chapter 17 and 18, God is giving a twofold message about what seduces people in this world. The first thing is idolatry and spiritual immorality and how people in this world pursue all of that instead of the worship of the one true God. Then in chapter 18, he is talking about commercial success and prosperity and materialism and how that seduces people to go off and follow and pursue money and luxury instead of worshiping the one true God. Now, what did we sing about this morning? Reign in me, we worship you. There is only one God. So either of those take people away from God, addict people in this world to things that are against God. And our call is to worship God. The two chapters go together, but this morning we're just looking at chapter 17. So let me give you a couple of definitions to help us follow the storyline. The woman is both a city and a spiritual force in this allegory. She is the ancient city of Babylon, which gave birth to idolatry, who continues to influence the world through false religions. And the beast in this story is a person, the final Antichrist, who leads Satan's attempt to dominate the world. The woman dominates the beast until the end of the story. And when we get to the end of chapter 17, you'll see what I mean, because then the beast turns against the woman and destroys false religion. So false religion is the wine of Satan that he uses to control humanity until he can establish his openly satanic kingdom on this earth. And then, you know, Satan has no more use for false religion then. All right, one more definition will help us see how seductive idolatry can be in our own lives. Because I have a feeling that we tend to think of idolatry as something, you know, weird over there, something that they do somewhere else. But in fact, idolatry is very powerful, and it is very addictive in the lives of Americans. It is very addictive and can be in our own lives. Henry Blackaby defined an idol as anything you turn to for help when God told you to turn to Him for help. Anything you turn to for help when God told you to turn to Him for help. Who's the focal point of your life? What is the focal point of your life? Where do you turn for help? If it's anyone other than God who is the most important thing in your life, if it's anything other than God, it is an idol. That's the power, the seductive power of idolatry. Most idolatry seems very innocent. Things that we don't even recognize at first in our lives. But like any narcotic, we can become addicted to idolatry. Dependent on something other than God for our sense of well-being in life. And when that happens, we may not even realize we are addicted to it until it is too late. That's the seductive power of this woman in Revelation 17. So, first of all, Satan's wine intoxicates the world. Secondly, Satan's kingdom stands united against God's people. Verse 6. Picking up halfway through the verse, "And when I saw her," John says, "I wondered greatly. And the angel said to me, 'Why do you wonder? I shall tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to come up out of the abyss and to go to destruction. And those who dwell on the earth will wonder, whose name has not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, when they see the beast, that he was and is not and will come. Here is the mind which has wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman sits, and they are seven kings. Five have fallen, one is, the other has not yet come, and when he comes, he must remain a little while. And the beast which was and is not is himself also an eighth, and is one of the seven, and he goes to destruction. And the ten horns which you saw are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called and chosen and faithful. All right, the angel explains the mystery of the woman called Babylon the Great so that we can understand what God is teaching us, and he begins by explaining the significance of the beast that she rides. The beast is the final Antichrist. Now, he symbolizes a person then. We met this beast back in Revelation chapter 13. Back in Revelation chapter 13, there were three members of the unholy Trinity, you remember. The dragon, the first beast rising out of the sea, and the second beast from the earth. The dragon, of course, was defined there as Satan himself. The first beast was the Antichrist, and the second beast was the false prophet. Now, the first beast, as the Antichrist, has something happened to him back in Revelation chapter 13. One of his heads has a fatal wound. One of the kings dies and then rises again from the dead, and the entire world is amazed at this feat that is accomplished by Satan the dragon and worships the image of the beast, worships the beast. The angel here is referring back to Revelation 13 when he says the beast was, but is not, and will come. He is referring to from the perspective of the people alive during that final period. The beast was, that is, he lived, he was a king, but he is not, he died, and he will come, as they're looking at that time period, rising out of the abyss where Satan's powers come from to be worshipped by this world. So he was, is not, but will come, but then go into, ultimately, destruction. So the people of the world wonder and worship the beast, but the people who worship the beast, we're told, are not found written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Written from the foundation of the world. It is clear then that every believer has his or her name written in the Lamb's Book of Life when? From the foundation of the world. All the way back to creation, God has written our names in the Lamb's Book of Life. We are secure in the Lord. We do not need to fear that the beast will overcome the true saints. For our security is in the Lamb and in the Book of Life, and our names are written there. What a comfort that is to know that God chose us before this world began to be His and to be His alone. And He keeps us from the clutches of the evil one. Oh, that doesn't mean that we don't experience failure. It doesn't mean that we don't experience the sufferings and the persecutions of the evil one. It doesn't mean that we will never sin. But it does mean that he protects us from the grasp of the evil one so that we, in the book of Revelation, those who are alive and follow the Lord, are overcomers. They are true believers. They persevere in him. So even in this horrible time at the end of the age, true believers will not be caught in the worship of the Antichrist. Secondly, all persecutors of God's people follow the same leader. The woman is seen sitting upon seven heads, which are seven mountains. The imagery was quite familiar to the people of Rome, of the Roman Empire during John's time, because it was the imagery of the goddess Dea Roma. coins were minted with Dea Roma sitting on the seven mountains. She was the mother goddess of Rome, who gave birth to the city of Rome. The city of Rome, of course, was built upon seven famous hills. And if you go to Rome today, you can still see somewhat the vestiges of those hills in the ancient part of the city of Rome. But John goes on to say that these seven heads or mountains are also seven kings. And the angel then lays out this interesting mathematical sequence for these seven kings. And this sequence, folks, is still debated today. And I'm not going to solve all of those problems this morning. It is the sequence of 5 + 1 + 1 = 7. And then he says in the next verse that the beast is actually an eighth. He comes out of the seven, but he's an eighth. So the mathematical sequence is 5 + 1 + 1 = 7 + 1 = 8. Got it? What does it mean? Well, that's a good question. Many have argued that the woman is the city of Rome. John is writing in Rome's day, living in the Roman Empire. She is called Babylon, they say, because the word Babylon was often used in the first few centuries by Christians as sort of a code name for the city of Rome. In fact, it's found in the scriptures that way. 1 Peter 5, verse 13 refers to the believers in Babylon, which is probably a code name for the city of Rome. Furthermore, the image of Dea Roma, that is, the goddess of Rome sitting on the seven hillsides, seems to fit that interpretation. The problem is that there is simply no way to make the Roman emperors, the Caesars, fit the mathematical sequence of 5 + 1 + 1 = 7 + 1 = 8. Multiple theories have been proposed for numbering these kings to fulfill the prophecy. The most common requires that John would have written the book of Revelation back in number 6, the Emperor Nero's time. The Emperor Nero is famous because there was a legend about the Emperor Nero after his death that he died and rose again and would come back to reconquer Rome. And so that seems to fit some of the other imagery of the beast in the book of Revelation. Preterists, those who believe that all of Revelation is fulfilled back in the first century, work very hard to figure out a way to make these kings fit the sequence. However, the evidence is extremely strong that John wrote Revelation during Domitian's reign at the end of the century, and even taking the three Galba, Otho, Vitellius emperors who reigned in quick succession as one, that's still the 10th king. It just doesn't fit. There's simply no way to make this list fit first century Rome and her kings with John writing at the end of the century. It is far better then to understand the imagery in keeping with the Old Testament prophet Daniel and the prophecies of the kingdoms, the empires that would dominate God's people. The kings then represent kingdoms that stand against God's people. In this sequence, there have been five that already existed: Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, and Greece. There is one functioning, as John writes, that was the Empire of Rome. So Rome would be the sixth kingdom. And then there was one yet to come after John, and the beast rises out of those and becomes an eighth empire. You with me this morning? You wanted to do math today, didn't you? Some argue that this cannot be because the word is kings and not kingdoms, and this would make it kingdoms. Well, that is true. The word is kings and not kingdoms. But it is also well established in the Old Testament prophecies that the word king and the word kingdom are used almost interchangeably. For kings came to represent and symbolize the kingdoms over which they ruled. And the terms become almost interchangeable in many Old Testament prophecies. So all of the prophecies here could very well be using kings as representing kingdoms, consistent with all of the Old Testament prophetic books. Furthermore, of course, it fits with the sequence that Daniel lays out and other prophecies, so it all fits with the prophetic work that we see in the Scriptures. They all teach the same sequence. What do we do with the woman sitting on the seven mountains then? I think it is a reference to Dea Roma, the mother goddess of Rome. She is the current visible representation of a power that has existed and continues to exist down through the centuries. The mother goddess is Babylon. But at any given time in history, idolatry has its visible symbols of this mother goddess in the forms of that current world kingdom. Dea Roma is simply the current form of this age-old idolatry. That is why I say that all persecutors of God's people follow the same leader, the mother goddess, called Babylon. She is the mother of idolatry. All right, this is a lot for a hot Sunday morning, isn't it? All right. Third principle, the eighth king is the final king. The beast that died and rose again to be worshipped at the end of this age comes out of the seven, but is himself an eighth. This eighth king is the final king to be controlled by the mother goddess called Babylon. She will go into destruction when God judges this world and her idolatry. Probably the simplest way and most common way to understand the passage, other than if you are trying to make it fit the first century, is that the seventh kingdom is the kingdom of the beast at the start of what we call the tribulation period, but after his resurrection, he takes on a role and establishes an eighth kingdom that is more evil than the seventh kingdom. That's the most common way to understand it. Am I allowed to speculate a little bit this morning? Sure, somebody said. Thank you, Norm. All right, I'm going to speculate a little bit, okay? And you take this as pure speculation, all right? I wonder if the seventh empire, the one that was to come after John, was actually a reference to Nazi Germany and Adolf Hitler and the attempts at genocide of the Israeli nationality, if you will, and that the only thing remaining now is the eighth kingdom, the kingdom of Antichrist, who comes out of the seven. That's speculation. That and a $1.50 might get you a cup of coffee, all right? You take it and go with it. All right, the final king has 10 warlords who don't have kingdoms until they're given kingdoms later on at the time of the eighth king, the beast. They rise to power with him. Just as, by the way, in Daniel's prophecy, the final kingdom has 10 toes. All right, so we're again consistent with the Old Testament. These 10 warlords have a short time to rule, and they give their allegiance to the beast. They have a common purpose with the beast. They are united with him in his desire to control this world. This coalition of kings will make war with the Lamb at the end of this age. So, when Christ returns, he will find the world involved in civil war. gathering in the Middle East. You remember last Sunday, we said that beginning in chapter 17 of Revelation, we are really having a commentary or an explanation of the seventh bowl angel at the end of chapter 16, who said that the world comes together at the very end for the battle of Armageddon, all right, in chapter 16, gathered in the Middle East. So now we are explaining more about that as we proceed through these next chapters. So when Christ returns, he finds the world involved in this civil war, gathering their armies in the Middle East. They will turn and face Christ and try to defeat the armies of Christ, but the Lamb will conquer them, we are told, because he is Lord of Lords and King of Kings. And all who are with the Lamb in that final great war for this earth are the ones who are called and chosen and faithful. That's us. Aren't you glad? Called and chosen and faithful. That's the true believers down through all of the ages and all of the centuries. We are the overcomers who stand with Christ, and we will enjoy the victory over the forces of Antichrist at the end of this age. Until then, the forces of Satan stand against God's people, and we face that persecution until the end of the age, till Christ returns. Third principle this morning. Satan's final leaders destroy the capital of false religion. Verse 15. And he said to me, this is the angel still speaking, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. So now we know that she was near to all of the peoples and nations of this world. And the ten horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot. And they will make her desolate and naked, and will eat her flesh, and will burn her up with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose, and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God should be fulfilled. And the woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Finally, the woman is identified. She is the great city that reigns over the kings and kingdoms of this earth. And I believe this is a reference to ancient Babylon itself, which I believe will be rebuilt to international importance at the end of this age. Let me explain why. Ancient Babylon is viewed down through the Old Testament as the source for all idolatry. She is the mother of idolatry in the Old Testament. This slide here is a picture of the Ishtar gate in ancient Babylon. Ishtar was the mother goddess of Babylon. She was known as the Queen of Heaven, the Mistress of Heaven. The Queen of Heaven was the mother of Babylon. And she was also worshipped. For the worship of Ishtar migrated into all kinds of other cultures, as Astarte in the Canaanite cultures. And later in John's day, in Asia Minor, she was known as Cybele. In John's day, Cybele was the great mother goddess, and her temples were found throughout the Roman Empire. She was even placed on equal footing with Dea Roma, because on Palatine Hill in Rome, where they did not allow temples to other gods and goddesses, one goddess was built a temple, and this was Cybele, the mother goddess. So she was equal status with Dea Roma, the goddess of Rome, the great mother of Rome. Cybele, the mother goddess, was worshipped in a very gory ritual. Her priests... A priest would stand under, down in a pit, under a bull that was being sacrificed live above the priest. And the blood from that sacrifice would cover the priest or the initiate if you were going to become a part of this worship, would cover and cleanse you by the blood of that bull and its sacrifice. There was a strong teaching in Mother Goddess worship of death and resurrection to new life in the power of the Mother Goddess. But we can trace this Queen of Heaven back much farther than that. We can go all the way back to the Tower of Babel in Genesis chapters 10 and 11. Nimrod was the famous founder of the first city of Babylon. The Tower of Babel was the first city of Babylon, way back in Genesis 10 and 11. And that became the leading city, and he attempted to build a tower that could reach to heaven to stand against God. You remember the story of the Tower of Babel? According to extra-biblical legends, Nimrod's wife was named Semiramis, who led the mystery religions of ancient Babylon and established the Queen of Heaven, the Goddess of Heaven theology. Semiramis supposedly, listen carefully, I know it's hot, but supposedly gave miraculous birth to a son. This is centuries before the birth of Christ, of course, way back, who was called Tammuz, and he was considered the savior of mankind. Tammuz supposedly fulfilled the promise made to Eve after creation of a son who would save humanity. Idols pictured Semiramis way back in Genesis, the time of Genesis 10 and 11, as the Queen of Heaven, and Tammuz, her miraculous Savior son, listen carefully, was supposedly killed but rose from the dead to lead an attempt at global religion antagonistic to the God of Heaven. Talk about a satanic counterfeit for the Father and the Son, the miraculous birth of the Son, and the death and resurrection of the Son, the worship of the Queen of Heaven, the Goddess, and her Son is as powerful a counterfeit as the world has ever seen. Ezekiel, the prophet, preached against the Queen of Heaven and the worship of Tammuz. Jeremiah preached against the worship of the Queen of Heaven that Israelites were getting caught up with. Zechariah preached against Babylon as the evil woman in Zechariah chapter 5. The Queen of Heaven migrated to many other cultures, including Rome. And in John's day, both Cybele and Dea Roma have associations with the ancient religion from Babylon. So Babylon, going all the way back to the Tower of Babel, is the mother of idolatry in this world, and her influence continues down through history in the kingdoms of this world. The prophet Jeremiah delivered a great prophecy about the end of Babylon in Jeremiah 50 and 51 that I think has not been completely fulfilled yet. And as I said, is the background for the woman of Revelation 17 and 18. The end of the Mother Goddess and her capital city actually comes at the hands of her own kingdoms. The beast and his 10 warlords turn against her in the end. Civil war develops in the kingdom of Satan. God's still in control. He influenced them to join together to destroy the woman. They hate this religion that has used them, and they end up burning down her capital city, destroying everything about false religion. So ultimately, you see, Satan has no use for false religion. Why would he? He wants worship himself. He will seek to eliminate it, though he has used it for his purposes down through history. So false religion is destroyed by Satan himself. In the end, God puts in the minds of Satan's leaders to get rid of the Mother Goddess once and for all. That Mother Goddess, though, has been ruling our world. She still is. False religion is a subtle, powerful, and seductive force in our world. And goddess worship, by the way, is alive and well. This week, I did a Google search on Ishtar. Guess what comes up? A whole bunch of sites on goddess worship that are alive and well today. The magical arts. Ishtar is still being worshipped. The Queen of Heaven is still being worshipped today. Goddess worship is alive and well. And idolatry, as we said, in many other forms, is alive and powerful. False religion numbs the mind. It dulls the senses that could be used to find real significance, because you only find that real significance in a relationship with God through Jesus Christ, His Son. But Satan's counterfeits, Satan's deceptions, will make people think they've found something important that gives them hope and joy. But in the end, it is always totally unsatisfying. And yet, people are constantly drawn to false religion, even today. James Kelly of Washington, D.C., is one of a small group at his local church who are enthusiastic Episcopalians, but who do not believe in God. You go to church, but you don't even believe in God. That's right. Said Kelly, "We all love the incense, the stained glass windows, the organ music, the vestments, and all of that. It's drama, it's aesthetics, it's the ritual. That's neat stuff. I don't want to give all that up just because I don't believe in God." Religion without a God? That's Satan's masterpiece of deception. Father, there is only hope, real hope, through Jesus Christ, your Son. My prayer is that everyone here this morning has placed their faith in Him for salvation and knows you personally, and is not caught up in the subtle powers of religion, of feeling like they're okay, but not. Father, draw us constantly to worship you and to worship you alone, and to trust in your Son and Him alone for our well-being. In Jesus' name, amen.